Thanks for tuning in. For Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 and 88.5, I'm Mark Purcell. Glad to have you along this morning. Last time we spoke with Amy Stewart, we were talking about wicked bugs. Before that, wicked plants. Now something more intoxicating. Amy Stewart's new book is called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. And Amy Stewart's on the phone with us this morning to talk about the new book. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So The Drunken Botanist, I read in the aperitif or intro section of the book, all began with a bottle of gin.
It did, yeah. I was hanging out in the lobby of a hotel with a friend of mine, Scott Calhoun, who is an agave expert and landscape designer in Tucson. And he said, you know, somebody gave me this bottle of Aviation Gin, and I'm not really a gin drinker. I don't know what to do with this stuff. And I said, well, I know what to do with it. I have a drink you will love. And so we ran around Portland, and we gathered up the ingredients, and we made this drink. And as the evening wore on, you know, we had a couple more. We're sitting around the bar. And I kept saying, you know, I can't believe you're not into gin, because as a plant person, you should love this stuff. It has so many interesting and really diverse plants in it. I mean, there's the grains that make the base alcohol. There's the juniper, which is a very weird sort of conifer, you know, shrub. And there's citrus, and there's all sorts of seeds and flowers and leaves. It's nothing but plants. Then I start looking around at the bar, and I'm like, you know, come to think of it, that's true of everything here. You know, tequila is just agave, and then there's some sugarcane over there, and there's some grapes over there. And I said, somebody ought to write a book about that. He was like, well, why don't you do it?
Well, I could imagine once you saw that cornucopia of ingredients that go into so many of our cocktails and looked at it from a botanist standpoint, it truly is quite a treasure trove. And I could imagine when you're starting to set up this book that you really had to decide how to bring these plants all to life. And I think you did a great job, beginning with what fermentation and distillation is, then going into how you basically can suffuse more flavors into that. How long did it take you to get this organizational map for the book?
Yeah, that was the challenge. I mean, there's a temptation to just do everything in alphabetical order. But I thought, you know, I think that in order for people to kind of get their heads around how these plants end up in the glass, it's important to think about the process. So that's why I decided to start with the plants that actually have enough sugar or starch for us to be able to ferment them and make alcohol. So that would be, you know, sugarcane for rum and agave for tequila and things like that. And then look at all the things that distillers add during the distillation process to change the flavor. So in gin, there's, you know, a dozen or so ingredients. Even beer, you know, hops are added as a flavoring. Hops don't produce alcohol. They just flavor the alcohol. So I categorized them like that. And then at the end, sort of part three is what you might mix in a drink or what a bartender might mix in a drink to change the flavor even more and to make a cocktail out of it.
As you began to dive into some of these plants and to this organizational scheme that you came up with, it really does seem that it begins to branch out in a hurry. If you start with say, gin, and as you said, you could go through the fermentation process, or the distillation process, rather, and then you suffuse some flavor in there, and then you're mixing a drink and you're adding more. It just seems to open up the whole taxonomy to making drinks.
That's right. You know, there are really very few plants anywhere in the world that haven't at one time or another been added to alcohol or made into alcohol. I mean, really, you know, the problem was that I did have to pick and choose, because the book would have been 4,000 pages long if I had included every possible fruit on the planet that's ever been fermented. It would have been endless.
So you settled on about 150 plants and flowers and trees and fruits and even a few fungi mixed in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only the history of how these plants have come about, but you also offer some drink recipes and growing tips for gardeners, too, pursuing your gardening passion.
Right, yeah. The drink recipes, what I wanted to do, since the subtitle of the book is The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, they're really classic cocktails that everybody should know how to make. But in my opinion, they're the best expression of that plant in the glass. And, of course, the growing tips, I mean, as a gardener, there are plants in here that I've never grown and never considered growing, but that are very specific to the cocktail world, and that's just really intriguing to me.
Well, as you were delving in this and opened up the Pandora's box, as you may, what surprised you the most as you learned about alcohol and the plants that surround us?
Well, you know, I think one surprising thing is that many of the things that we drink today as a cocktail ingredient really did start out as medicine. A lot of the herbal liqueurs, like chartreuse, for example, really do have their roots as early medicine. You know, all we had for medicine was plants, right? I mean, until modern pharmaceuticals came along, that's what we had. And the way to preserve those plants and keep them on the shelf so you can actually give them to somebody when they get sick was to drop them into alcohol. So we weren't distilling anything until about 800 AD. That's about when the technology got good enough for us to know how to do this. So before 800 AD, nobody on the planet had ever had a stiff drink.
But they had a drink because there was fermentation that was involved.
And, that's right.
And as I recall, there was a, I believe I read an article just recently that talked about how grain was grown first to brew beer, not necessarily to make bread.
Yes, this is really interesting. So that's sort of the new frontier for archaeologists who study this stuff, is that there are probably a lot of plants around the world that got brought into cultivation, not first for food, but first to make booze. And we can laugh about that and say, you know, yeah, I bet they needed a drink. Life was tough back then. But you know what? It was really a pretty healthy beverage. Water sources get contaminated easily, and there was no understanding of water treatment or of the parasites or bacteria that could end up in water. And even a little bit of alcohol, even something that's only 3 or 4% alcohol, can clean up some of those pathogens and make it safer to drink. So there really was an important reason to do it.
Well, out of all your explorations, what did you become most intrigued with as you were writing The Drunken Botanist? What really was an aha or eye-opening moment for you?
You know, one of the things for me was really thinking very globally about this. When we talk about booze and when we talk about our cocktail culture, we tend to think about North America and Europe. But in fact, there are these global drinking traditions that I think we forget about. So I really tried to pay attention to Africa and India and Asia. There's a couple things from Australia and New Zealand in there, and South America as well. So whether you're looking at fruits that might have been used by indigenous people to make something like a wine or a beer a long time ago, or even what's still being made around the world, there's a whole drinking culture that I think we forget about. And I think it's sort of the global nature. You know, it's something that brings us all together, right?
Right. I mean,
two strangers can get to know each other over a beer, and two cultures, I think, can connect as well over their shared drinking traditions.
I found it fascinating that you not only talk about the plants, but bugs as well, and how bugs have played a role in many cases with some of our favorite alcoholic beverages.
Yes, I mean, you know, as the author of a book on bugs, I kept running across them, and I just could not resist putting them in there. So, believe it or not, there are some that actually end up in the bottle even today. Cochineal scale is an example. This is a tiny little sucking insect. If there's any gardeners out there listening, they know what scale is, and this is a species that gives off this bright red fluid, you know, that's what it exudes. And it's used as a coloring even today in some red liqueurs. But they play all kinds of roles. You know, bugs actually help move yeast around. So in terms of fermentation and getting the right yeast into your brew, there was a time when bugs carrying yeast around was actually pretty important.
Very fascinating and, you know, pun intended, intoxicating subject, Amy. I appreciate you shedding more light on it.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Amy Stewart, the author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, available where books are sold. You can find a link to learn more about Amy and The Drunken Botanist and Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs on our website, wvxu.org. Thanks again, Amy.
All right. Thank you.